As many of you know, this past summer, I completed a unit of clinical pastoral education at St. Louis University Hospital, which is a level one trauma center in the heart of the city. And to be honest, serving as a chaplain in a hospital is not a natural role for me. Because you see, chaplains' main job is to tend to the emotional lives of others. They tend to the heart. And I tend to engage more with my mind than my heart. I'm inclined to focus on ethics and principles and intellectual knowledge. And I have a tendency to forget that sometimes I'm talking to real human beings with real human emotions. And so my natural inclinations make chaplaincy a really challenging job for me. The act of pastoral care forces me to interrogate my own fear of emotions and to integrate my head with my heart. And as I noted in a sermon before I left for the summer, chaplaincy's focus on emotions, it really scared me. I was bone marrow afraid of what I would encounter in the hospital. And I was so anxious that first day of orientation that I gave myself this psychosomatic fever, and I had one of the most painful stomach aches I've ever had. And I have chronic acid reflux, so I know a good stomach ache. And this anxiety was really rooted in the conception of myself, the shame that I felt. I feared that I'd never be good enough to be a chaplain. I feared that I would say the wrong thing, that I would cause additional distress, and that people would see behind the veil and recognize that I'm just a cold-hearted intellectual, and that is it. And I'm telling you, I really worked myself up. And my peers and my supervisors had to constantly remind me, right? People who saw me do visits had to constantly remind me that my conception of myself did not match my ability to serve patients. And I share this story because I want to share more about what I learned this summer about ministering to people in crisis. Because ultimately, yes, it's the job of a pastor to be there for people in their moment of need, but it's also the job of all of us that as our congregation ages, that we're going to encounter people who are processing death, who are processing new medical conditions, who are processing poor prognoses, and we have to be the people who are there for them. And I know that I'm not the only one who feels scared about providing care to people in crisis. It's a very human thing. Because when someone dies, oftentimes we wonder, what are we supposed to say to comfort the bereaved? When we hear of someone receiving devastating medical news, we might want to help, but we're not sure if our help would be burdensome. And we might wonder, am I close enough to this person to care for them? And our fear might tell us things like, you know what? That person who had a crisis, they got plenty of people around them. They don't need my help. And it's very human to be scared to provide this care. But that fear can be overcome, right? I had to do it every single day. I had to pump myself up before going to that hospital room to get over that fear to provide care for people who really needed it. And to be clear, when I say providing care in moments of need, I don't mean sending some one-off text and checking that off our list. I don't mean saying a private prayer which the person in crisis never hears. And I don't even mean dropping off a casserole. These acts are wanted and needed, and we should keep doing them, but they allow us to operate at this very safe emotional distance. Because I'm not scared to cook a casserole, but I am scared to dive deep into the depths of one's emotionality and to respond with empathy. And so when I speak about care, I mean this sort of radical care. I mean becoming vulnerable by engaging in an active form of listening. I mean being able to wade in the messiness of someone's life without trying to provide them with some sort of cheap solutions. I mean parking ourselves into a chair in a living room and listening without offering platitudes which do not reflect the enormity of the crisis that someone is experiencing. And so when I speak about these sort of like platitudes, I think about three phrases that are very normal to say when people are in crisis, but that they often exacerbate the problem. The first phrase is very theological. We say things like, it's all part of God's plan. And it's one thing, right, when you're caring for someone and maybe they say to you, this is all part of God's plan, it's all going to work out. That's one thing, right? You nod your head in affirmation when the person is telling you that, because crisis is never the time to change one's theology. But it's another thing for us to insert our own narrative. It's all part of God's plan, no big deal. It's to insert that into the conversation. We reduce the person's experience by claiming it's meant to be. And I think in moments of crisis, we should be weary of depicting a God who endorses human suffering. The second phrase, which is really reflexive, and I know I say it all the time, is, it's okay, right? Everybody says it. Somebody is in crisis. We pat them on the back. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's not okay, right? There's real injury. There's real suffering. And we want to be careful not to minimize the person's experience. And this is the number one thing they told us all the time in chaplaincy. Stop saying it's okay. It's not. And the third phrase here, it's also theological. It's like, it'll all work out in the end. Or put in a Christian lens, it'll all work out in the end because we'll all go to heaven. And this phrase has really good intentions. But the fact is that we as humans have a tendency to put silver linings on things. But sometimes we have to reckon with the fact that life is tragic. Sometimes things won't work out. There will be pain and distress and death. And it is better for us to sit in that pain with someone else, to be present alongside them, than to try to evade it. I think fear produces these phrases. Because in the midst of a crisis, it's really easy to want to put a bow on things, to try to find quick solutions, to try to find cheap solutions, to try to make the person feel better temporarily. But this fear of diving deep into one's emotionality prevents us from caring for people in ways which they deserve to be cared for. And I think today's gospel text demonstrates this better way. It demonstrates, one, how one might ask for help, and it demonstrates how one might care for another experiencing a crisis. Our story depicts Jesus' interactions with a blind man named Bartimaeus. And the first thing the story teaches us, and this is really important, is that we should ask for help. If we have a need, we must ask, even if it means being vulnerable and hurting our reputation. The Bible describes Bartimaeus as a blind beggar sitting by the roadside. And since Bartimaeus is described as a beggar, I'm willing to bet that his reputation is already damaged in the community. I'm willing to bet that people look down on him. He probably lacks community. He probably is all alone. And his loneliness might cause him to believe that no one could ever care for him. He might even doubt his inherent worth is one made in the image of God. And to be honest, if I'm in Bartimaeus' situation, I'm going to be in my head. And I'm going to convince myself that Jesus, this new teacher with healing powers, would never be willing to help little old me. I would be scared of rejection. I would be scared of being a burden for someone else. Yet Bartimaeus is the perfect example because he overcomes these fears. these very human fears, and asks for help. He not only asks, he shouts. He shouts, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And as he shouts, people in the crowd scold him. They tell him to be quiet. They try to silence Bartimaeus's pain. But Bartimaeus, he just keeps shouting, "Son of David, have mercy on me." And by continuing to shout, Bartimaeus risks his already damaged reputation because he is committed to asking for help despite judgment. And what's so great here is that that commitment is rewarded. That when he asks for help, Jesus says to him, "Call him here." And then Jesus, this omniscient savior of the world, asks Bartimaeus, "What do you want me to do for you?" And this is so important, right? Jesus asks him. He doesn't assume that this blind man coming up to him means that Bartimaeus wants to see again. Jesus wants to help Bartimaeus in the way which Bartimaeus wants to be helped. Jesus asks because radical care requires consent. You know, if a person does not want our help, it's difficult. But if the person does not want it, we have to honor that request. However, consent doesn't mean that we have to sit back and wait to be asked. Unlike the biblical account, we often need to reach out to people experiencing distress. Because the people in our lives who are distressed are now not out on Main Street shouting at us. Sometimes our visits and our phone calls have to be the people who initiate this communication. And when we do initiate an interaction with someone who is sick or in crisis, our focus, like Jesus, should be on listening. We should do three things: ask open-ended questions, leave room for silence, and allow the other person to share their story. We're simply there to be present and to listen. And if I'm being honest, it doesn't always go as clean as the gospel text, right? Sometimes our first attempts to care for another person can be met with resistance because we live in a world where we're told not to ask for help. So in the hospital, many of my first visits with patients would be a long and awkward 5 minutes. And I'd say to myself, "I'm never going back in there." But when I did, oftentimes what would happen is that same person who was resistant to talking to me, who didn't trust me with their story, would open up and share. And those visits would last for an hour, for 90 minutes. Right? And the lesson here is that trust has to be built. Our first attempt at caring for someone won't always lead to this feel-good, long interaction where it feels like we've helped someone. Because we have to prove that we are committed to practicing presence. And after Jesus, going back to the story, asked Bartimaeus how he might help, Jesus responds, "My teacher, let me see." I'm sorry, Bartimaeus responds, "Jesus, let me see," because Jesus is not blind. And then Jesus responds, "Go, your faith has made you well." And Jesus listens to this request of the blind man and grants him the healing he desires. Jesus practices this radical care. And our own acts of care, like I've said, won't be so short and concise. The Gospel of Mark is famous for being very short and to the point. Unlike Jesus, we don't have sacred utterances which miraculously heal people. But in our interactions with each other, we can do two things: practice curiosity and practice empathy. Curiosity and empathy are two of the most important tools in our mental health toolkit. And this really bothers me. We have like the Red Cross who does first aid classes, CPR classes. We all have some sort of toolkit for physical health. But we should also have tools that we can use to minister to someone who experiences a crisis, because we never know when we're going to be in places where that just happens. And so curiosity, practicing it means showing more interest in the other person's story than in yourself. Curiosity prevents us from conflating our experience and our story with the other person's story. Curiosity empowers us to listen with kindness. And we can show curiosity by asking those open-ended questions. We might say something like, these are three magical words, tell me more. And the person opens up and shares more of their story. Or we might say something like, I'd love to hear more about X. How does this experience make you feel? Or how can I be helpful to you? And by practicing curiosity, we are proving to the other person that we genuinely care about them. Another tool is empathy. When our curiosity allows a person to share a painful story, we have to be prepared to seek to understand that person's perspective. And we can make sure we are understanding correctly by saying things like, you know, it sounds like you're feeling blank. And if we're tracking with the other person, that person will agree with us and continue talking. But if we're not tracking, which is completely okay because it's very hard to be empathetic, it allows the person to disagree with us, say, no, I'm more feeling this way. Or through negative body language, show us that we're not tracking what they say. Other empathetic phrases we might use that I use all the time at the hospital are, I imagine you must be blank. Or if I were you, I would be feeling blank. And all of these phrases reflect a person's emotions back to them and communicate that you indeed want to listen, that you indeed want to be there for them, that you indeed care about them as they struggle through pain and adversity. Now, I share these things in light of a survey that our session commissioned in April to assess our church's response, our initial response to the COVID-19 pandemic. 56 individuals responded to this survey, which is about the number of people who worship with us each week. 60% of respondents reported that they were feeling isolated. 1 in 3 parishioners report that they have, quote, not felt connected during the pandemic. And what's most troubling for me is that nearly 1 in 4 people communicated that they were not sure who they could reach out to at church if they experienced a need. And that's troubling to me because if 1 in 4 people who care enough about our congregation to fill out a survey, communicate that they don't know who among us they can reach out to in a time of need, I think that means that our church has to rethink the ways that we care about one another. It means that church leadership, including myself, must do a better job to ensure that every member of our community has at least one person, if not several, that they can go to when they're in need of help. And I want to share with you a couple of ways that we're working right now to address these concerns and to shift our approach to care. One of the largest complaints during the pandemic, especially when we were all online, was that people did not know when others in our congregation were experiencing medical issues or other forms of distress. And in that survey, people reported feeling frustrated because they want to be there for people. They want to care, but they don't know the people who need it. And in response, I'm working with Mickey Stook, who is one of our ruling elders, to create a sort of prayer list, which will serve as a hub to communicate who in our congregation has a medical issue, who in our congregation is in need of prayer, and thus probably also in need of a visit, of a call, of a text, or maybe even a casserole. And I'm committed to praying for these individuals every Sunday during our prayers of the people, to remind us that there are people here who need our care and to believe that God answers prayers, that prayer is powerful. And so tomorrow morning, you'll receive an email, hopefully, with a prayer request form, which allows you to communicate specific requests. And you'll be able to also access this form eventually on our website. I do want to caveat this form and say that I know that there's some people in our congregation who prefer that their medical issues remain private, that only staff members know. And there's going to be a place on the form where you can say, this is a confidential request. Or a place on the form where you can say, this is non-confidential and I want it to be prayed with all of the church. Because we're only going to publicly pray for those who have made these non-confidential requests. Because again, radical care requires consent. And if you're someone who doesn't do email, that's fine too. You can always call Christy. You can always call Sherrod or myself. We are here when you need us. A second thing that a structure we're hoping to change is that many in our congregation have requested that we create shepherding groups, which would be led by our deacons. And Sherrod's working with a committee of deacons and elders chaired by Margaret Ann Trail to structure these groups. And the details aren't final, but this is what it might look like. A deacon or our congregation will be split up into smaller flocks. And a deacon will be assigned to each flock. And that deacon will serve as that group's primary contact. The assigned deacon will periodically reach out to those members and see if there's anything the church could be doing for them. And if you are part of their flock, you are always free to communicate with them directly if you experience a need. And the committee hopes that we will have these groups finalized in the next couple of months, hopefully in January. These are just two small structural changes that we're hoping to make to allow us to do a better job of fostering a culture of care, of radical care. But to ensure that we meet the needs of everyone in this congregation, we need you. Right? Radical care requires the participation of each of us. And I look out and I imagine that many of us are exhausted by the last 2 years, by the circumstances of our world. And I imagine this exhaustion leaves us feeling like we barely have the energy to care for ourselves, let alone care for each other. And this exhaustion, it tempts us to turn inward, to be like the people in the gospel who scold Bartimaeus when he asks for help. And exhaustion might tempt us to look into the pews and say, I see a lot less people. I wonder if it's time to give up on church altogether. But I would argue that now is not the time to retreat. It's the time to come together and work towards revitalization. It's time to bet on this community. It's time to care for each other in ways which we deserve to be cared for. To make sure that each of us experiences genuine belonging and connection right here in this space. Things can get better. And after nearly 2 years of isolation, people are craving connection. People are hungry for places where they can belong. And if we create an environment of radical care, a culture where all who come and worship here feel like they belong, perhaps more people will want to be part of that community. And regardless, in the midst of this exhaustion and isolation, God says to us, go, your faith has made you well. You know, have faith that when you ask for help, that there are people here who will meet your needs or will try their best to do it. Have faith that you can be someone who practices radical care. If someone like me who is scared of emotions can practice it, you can too. Have faith that you can be the person who walks alongside someone in the midst of crisis. Have faith in your ability to be curious and empathetic. Have faith that God empowers you, that God is still working here, that God has not left us, but is here within us, the Spirit working inside of us to empower us to care for each other. We must not let exhaustion, spurred by evil forces in this world, engender retreat. We must have faith in the living God. God promises to be present in suffering and to ensure that there are people in our lives who love and care for us. God reminds us that pain and suffering never have the final word. Right? That's the story of Christ, that Christ died, but that was not the end of the story. That Christ's story ends in resurrection and new life. And in our story today, Bartimaeus doesn't end blind. He can see. Friends, new life beckons. There are opportunities to revitalize and restore. The Spirit continues to equip you with the tools you need to overcome fear so that all in this space may feel radical care, may feel like they belong. And I hope that this can happen here. I hope that each of us chooses to participate in a culture of caring for each other. May it be so. Amen.